Recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Eric Singular. Welcome to the Hoban Minute. It has been a minute since we have been in this studio together, Bob. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well. How are you? Happy New Year, Eric. It's good to be here. It's good to be back.
It really is. It really is. And as you said yesterday, we're trying to keep a Barney level of enthusiasm as we enter this new year. Not because all of this is behind us, but because that attitude, as you said, you get back what you put out. And I think that's an important thing, an important, theme that we'll probably try to stick to this year on the Hoban Minute.
Well, it's true. And it kind of sounds a little bit hokey, but it's been my experience in life, and I think it's an absolute fact. You get back the energy you put out there. If you put out positivity and you put out a positive message and an upside and a bright side, particularly in a new year, well, yes, did anything change on December 31st to January 1st? Nothing changed. It's a fictitious deadline on a calendar, but it provides one thing, and that's a reset and a hope. And we all sort of measure our lives, our objectives, our plans professionally and personally by periods of time. It gives us a chance to come back and say, things are going to be better this year. And that's a fact. They are going to be better this year, but we have to get through some things first. But the only way you're going to get there, and the only way those good things are going to happen to you, is to put out that positivity and preach that message. And that's what we've always tried to do here. But now we've got 2021. We've got a lot of changes. We've got political changes. We've got policy changes, all that affect the general population, but also our industry, this industry in particular, the cannabis industry. So lots of exciting stuff to happen. That doesn't minimize the heaviness of the pandemic and the heaviness of what's happening politically in this country, but it does provide not a light at the end of the tunnel, because we don't have to wait to get to the end of the tunnel for that light. We're in the light right now. It's just that light's only going to get brighter.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, on this idea of a reset, this is a new year that brings some extra weight because we are going to see a new administration come into play here. And actually just today, we saw those two Georgia Senate seats go to the Democrats. And I know when you commented on the MORE Act in your recent Forbes article, you basically kind of laid out that it was, did federal cannabis legalization almost weigh on this Georgia runoff election today? So it's having a big impact right now across the country, the Senate going to the Democrats. And does it give the MORE Act more of a chance of passing? We talked about that a little bit with Andrew D'Angelo, but it certainly is going to have an effect. And I think we can already feel that because we're seeing the reactionary effect in the streets right now. I don't know how exactly you want to comment on that, but it's certainly something you seem to anticipate a little bit, that even the passing of that MORE Act may have been a move on the Democrats' end to encourage more voter turnout and more of that blue wave in this runoff election today.
Well, there's a lot to unpack in that, Eric. And at the end of the day, the fact of the matter is, yes, the Senate itself is balanced 50 Dems, 50 Republicans, of course, with the president of the Senate being our vice president, who is our incoming vice president, of course, is a Democrat, tilting the majority in favor of that. Now, it still doesn't mean the Senate's going to function well when you have that balance. It's not like the vice president spends her time in the Senate as that active sort of 51st member of the Democratic Party. As a procedural matter, it's a tiebreaker in effect. So it's going to create a lot of challenges. And typically the majority party in the Senate is the one that sets the agenda and, you know, allows things to come to a vote, et cetera, et cetera. So that was certainly one of the reasons why people vote. Of course, people vote and pick political sides for a multitude of reasons. And remember, every single policy issue that exists in politics in the United States has to fit in one of two boxes. That never made sense. It doesn't make sense today, but that is the way it works. So whether it's because of cannabis, whether it's because of I want my $2,000 versus my $600 from the stimulus, whatever the reasons, people got out and they voted. And ultimately, the Democrats did win in Georgia. And that does shift the balance. Now, unfortunately, what we're seeing on the streets today in Washington, D.C., it's just tremendously unfortunate because it's effectively driven by a narrative from our president, our current president, who you try to be objective about these things. And, you know, I've weighed the opportunity. I've said on this podcast, we've talked about this. If the president, after losing that election, wanted to proceed with series of lawsuits, that's his prerogative. You can't hold fault for someone for going through that process. But when you've run through that process with 60 plus lawsuits and none have come out in your favor, and all of the evidence, quote unquote evidence, that you suggest exist that would indicate that the election was quote unquote stolen has been debunked, legitimately debunked, not in a partisan fashion, legitimately debunked, not received, not accepted by courts of law, which I believe operate in a fair and objective manner in this country by and large. And when you have 60 lawsuits, there's something to be said there when none of them move forward. So that is something that ultimately colors this and really makes it a sad day in American politics. And it's been a sad month plus in American politics that our president continues to maintain this false narrative that is blatantly false, and none of the facts would support that the election was stolen. And it seems to me that this is creating discord. Now, let's spin it back to the cannabis issue, because that's our focus here. With a balance and a majority effectively in the Senate, and Harris, our vice president, incoming vice president, being a sponsor of the MORE Act, and it being a bipartisan measure to begin with, it's highly likely that that piece of legislation will come back around and somehow will get enacted in this Democratic presidential term. Does that mean it's going to happen in the first 6 months, the first 2 years? That remains to be seen. There's many other wounds to heal. There's many other issues to address politically and from a policy perspective. And let's not forget, we also have to get through this pandemic. Assuming there is another side to this pandemic, which is what we all believe, and we think the vaccines will get us there more quickly, but no one really knows. So there's a lot of ifs going forward, but amongst all that that to unpack, there is, as we've mentioned before, it's a bright upside for this industry. The economy's down in large part because of the pandemic, in large part because of lockdowns. Will that bounce back as quickly as it bounced back from the spring to the summer in the United States before the sort of restrictions were reinstituted when the winter came around? That remains to be seen. But the quicker it bounces back, the more that will play into the success of the cannabis industry, because it's a consumer-driven industry, of course. It has so many facets to it. And we've talked about this before, so I won't beat the dead horse. But cannabis and the commercial regulated market was born during a recession. So an economic downturn, even a depression, won't seem to steer that off course, particularly with some of the numbers we've seen in 2020 surrounding this. So lots of upside there, and the political landscape is going to create a lot of fervor. Even before the Canadian government enacted legislation to legalize cannabis several years ago, when there was just the possibility, because Trudeau was elected into a prominent position there as the prime minister of that country, and said, this is something I support and this is something I'm going to drive. Based on that alone, we saw enormous capital, enormous entrepreneurial movement in the cannabis industry. The same thing is going to happen here based on the fact that we've got a Democrat-controlled Congress and executive branch that ultimately has taken a public position and advanced legislation that would deschedule cannabis and create more opportunities for a commercial regulated industry, in addition to all the importance of criminal justice reform and social justice reform as well. So lots of positive things, but that fervor, that activity, it's going to be off the charts if it's not already, because of the possibilities of what's to come. And this is, as we've talked about also, what many of these multi-state operators, many of these investors, many of these companies across the United States have been banking on. Literally. what is going to happen in a post-prohibition America. Does it happen this year, next year? Maybe not, but it's likely to happen because these same politicians, the same party has already advanced that policy change.
We'll come back to the MORE Act in just a second, but there's a loop from a previous podcast episode that I think we need to close, and that is the inauguration that's coming up here. So we had posited whether or not Donald Trump, President Trump, would attend the inauguration of Biden. I don't know if it's going to happen. And as you mentioned previously, there's precedent for not attending an inauguration, although it's pretty old precedent, a couple hundred years. Do you think as of today we will see Trump at the Biden inauguration?
Here's my question. Do you really want him there? Do you want someone that promotes this kind of discord and these conspiracy theories to affect people's health and safety? Do you want that person at the inauguration? If you're President-elect Biden, do you want Donald Trump at that election? Yes, it signals so much for our democracy, and it's been historically how we've measured our democracy in terms of a peaceful transition of power. But Eric, this ain't a peaceful transition of power. We've seen it today. Do you want that man there? I would posit that you don't. In fact, if he showed up, I wouldn't see him, to be honest with you, because you don't want that sideshow. This is supposed to be, this is a ceremonial transfer of power that is the basis of our democracy, and it's been undermined by someone who refuses to recognize that we have a history and rules and a constitution, and that facts matter across the board. So we've also seen that Donald Trump, oh, he wanted to go to Scotland, but they wouldn't let him in, or at least that's what you read. Whether that's true or not, I debate all of that anymore because you don't know whether what you read is true. And then you've heard, oh, Trump's going to have a competing rally in Florida during this inauguration. Who the heck knows what's going to happen? But from my perspective, as much as I believe in the peaceful transition of power, you almost don't want the man there. Because we need to move on from someone who just has little regard for the truth and for our Constitution and our history. And it's just, you know, I because I'm not a dyed-in-the-wool Democrat. You know, I'm very objective with politics. But at the end of the day, something that that Joe Biden keeps saying sticks with me is we need to return to decency. And politicians aren't always decent. And Donald Trump's an extreme example of indecency in a political role, in my opinion. I didn't always think that way, by the way, but certainly that's exhibited itself in recent months and in the past year. But do you really, you don't want someone there that's going to just continue to embarrass our political process. And that's really the answer. And again, that history of many, 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 many years ago, hundreds of years ago, in fact, at the beginning of this nation is the last time that at least I've been able to find that a president did not attend the inauguration for his successor. So we'll see if this is the second time around, but we might actually hope that it's the second time around.
Yeah, these kinds of ceremonies hold a strong symbolic value. And for someone to be there and not honor that.
It's not just a game, Eric. It matters. Things like this matter. It's the reason you don't walk into a room, even if you know the president of the United States on a personal level, you still walk into a room and you call that person Mr. President. You respect decorum. You respect the protocols. You respect the ceremonial and the pageantry elements of what this country has been built around. And other countries around the world have similar things in place. That's the decorum, that's the decency that we're talking about. Politics and policies aside, you don't want someone who has no respect for those things in place. We need to move past this. And I'm keeping my fingers crossed that this is not the new normal for this country and politics, because that would be just deleterious to our democracy.
Wow, absolutely. So, to come back to the MORE Act, it's definitely a positive piece of legislation, but something I'd like to get you to comment on is how you think, if it did pass or was enacted into law, would it have an impact, or would there be some friction between states like Colorado and California that have legalized recreational cannabis would that be a seamless transition, or would there be potentially some issue with the legislation of the MORE Act interacting with these state initiatives for legalization?
Yeah, the MORE Act would create a number of challenges. Now, we've talked about this at length, and Andrew D'Angelo did a great job of summarizing some of its high points, so I won't go into it too deeply. But the MORE Act, while it did deschedule cannabis, or does deschedule cannabis, its primary focus is criminal and social justice reform. So to create a commercial industry, additional work needs to be done. Additional legislation would need to be enacted. Enormous amount of regulatory work. We've seen how long it's taken the FDA, for example, to implement the tenets of the 2018 Farm Bill. We've seen how long it took the USDA to come around and issue rules surrounding that. And that was 2 years ago, and it doesn't look like anytime soon we're going to have clarity on that. And that was a fairly simple issue. That's agriculture, industrial hemp. We're talking about something that has a stigma and has a psychoactive or a intoxicating component to it by definition, that you don't just move that so fast. And that's going to be a challenging thing. So the state initiatives are critically important. The descheduling element could be perceived or interpreted to defer then to the state regulatory programs, and that could allow those state programs to set the standard, and the federal government simply sits back and says, here's a baseline standard for those state regulatory programs, and that would create some uniformity and some consistency up front. But at the end of the day, it's moving fast. We talked about the SAFE Banking Bill. We talk about the STATES Act. We talk about, you know, tax reform surrounding cannabis. All of those things in bite-sized pieces are far more manageable, still complex, and still will take a lot of time to implement. But to just outright deschedule cannabis, that's going to be a challenge. And it also mirrors the discussion we've had previously about the United Nations recommending the reclassification of cannabis under the 1961 UN Convention, which over the next year plus, will require those member nations, those signatory nations of that UN convention from 1961 to change their laws, including the United States. So all of this is going to unpack over time, and none of it's easy. And it's ultimately going to get bogged down with a political divide because that's the nature of the beast and frankly, the nature of the business.
In your mind, does the political landscape becoming more blue favor the Safe Banking Act getting passed here in the near future? I know Andrew touched on that a little bit, but do you see, obviously, and this is something a lot of folks who we've had on the podcast have made note of, which is that this administration that's coming in has got huge fish to fry as far as the pandemic, as far as a number of other important issues. But do you think that the Safe Banking Act at least stays in the middle of people's mind, maybe not the forefront, doesn't just completely fall off here in the next couple of sessions?
All of the potential, the pace of the potential cannabis policy and cannabis law reforms at the federal level will be dictated by the economy, in my opinion. The economy will dictate whether it continues to get worse because of the pandemic and the shutdowns. The economy will dictate the need to implement things like the Safe Banking Act more quickly. For example, if revenues are down for the governments across the country, and they certainly are, because you know revenues are down across the board in just about everything because of the pandemic. If in fact those governments want to be sure that they're getting their quote unquote cut, their taxes from cannabis business operators, then the Safe Banking Act goes in that direction. It provides that verifiable certainty in conjunction with software that's track and trace and inventory tracking software that's already largely mandatory at the state level. It creates that combination of certainty so that every cent, every dollar is tracked and accounted for in the industry. That's in part what the Safe Banking Act does. It also opens up doors so that money that does exist out there on the sidelines that's been waiting to get in can be more easily and legitimately funneled into this industry when it, as we mentioned, it continues to grow regardless of the economic cycles and regardless of whether we're in a recession or depression or otherwise. So the Safe Banking Act and tax reform are probably two of the easiest things, but Whether they come tomorrow or in 18 months depends on the economic impact of COVID and the continuing economic impact or decline associated with that.
You made reference to the pace at which we've seen the FDA try to tackle non-psychoactive cannabinoids like CBD in the wake of the 2014 and the 2018 Farm Bill implementation. This kind of brings us around to the piece of legislation that we saw Rand Paul introduce right there at the end of the year, the Hemp Act, which we haven't really gotten a chance to talk about since we've been on here. And so I'm really interested in your thoughts on where that piece of legislation might lead to, but also keeping in mind that if we are going to bump the allowable THC threshold up to 1%, while we're already dealing with these enormous regulatory delays from both the USDA and the FDA on hemp regulations, don't you think that just kind of muddies the water even a little bit more? Obviously, there's a lot of great arguments for the things that are in the Hemp Act and that move to 1%, but it definitely seems that we don't need anything else holding down or stalling these regulatory agencies to just get us to a place with industrial hemp where we don't feel like our hands are tied.
The enactment of the 2014 and then subsequently the 2018 farm bills, to a lesser extent than what the MORE Act would do on the marijuana or the cannabis side, as they say, it was very complex. It moved very, very quickly. It created confusion and intentional misdirection by government agencies such as the DEA. It created confusion at the FDA and the USDA and law enforcement all across the country because it happened and then people weren't even necessarily informed in those prominent positions of law enforcement and otherwise that this had occurred. It happened so quickly. So it almost happened in a way that, all right, now it's legal. Go out and figure this out. And of course, what drives the market, what drives the development of an industry, it's follow the money, right? What do consumers want? So early on, they wanted CBD. So the industry was driven towards a CBD industry. Hemp, as we've talked about at length, is much more than just CBD. It's far more than just cannabinoids, although that's a prominent and a very important part of this plan. So we've had no opportunity to develop an infrastructure, no opportunity to create any stability or any real supply chain for the farmers. So then you're going to go around and turn it yet again in a direction where increasing the THC percentage, while many farmers want it because it would create more efficient production of cannabinoids, the cannabinoid marketplace, while it exists, it's not regulated right now. There is no solid commercial foundation for that industry. And we don't know how long the FDA is going to take to act. And we're going to have a new regime at the FDA under a Democratic executive branch. So at the end of the day, what is it that we want to make these changes for to address, you know, it's like that notion of doctors treat symptoms. They don't address the illness. This seems like that bill, while I can see the importance of some of the components of it, it seems like that bill addresses symptoms of a growing pain. It doesn't address the growing pain. And that's really where we are. We need to let the industry grow. To grow, you're going to take two steps back, a couple steps forward, three steps back. That's the nature of a growing industry. But we know what this plant's capable of. We know we've got the technology to get there. You just have to move slowly but surely. Hemp came out of the box extraordinarily quickly, in large part because of CBD. But the hemp industry is not just CBD. So we need to let it evolve a little bit further, in my opinion, before we make these drastic changes that address the symptoms versus address the actual condition. You want to address the condition, do things like the USDA are doing, provide grants for supply chain development, try to create conditions where infrastructure is being developed, trying to create more certainty surrounding hemp genetics so farmers can know what they're planting and that they begin to develop supply chains, both domestically and internationally, for the parts of the plant, including but not limited to cannabinoids. So while I applaud the efforts of Senator Rand Paul, and certainly, you know, his position in Kentucky has put hemp very clearly close to his heart and close to him as a prominent policy position, you know, Is it really necessary right now? Farmers would say it is. Suppliers would say it is. But I also think, again, that's addressing a specific, I think, short-term need, not a long-term direction or even a medium-term vision about what this industry can be.
I absolutely agree. And you really look at the language of that Hemp Act, and it really is much more on the cannabinoid-focused side of the hemp industry here in the United States. I think this is really going to be the year of fiber here in the U.S. I think we are in for a really, really interesting production
2021 is the year of fiber.
That's my prediction. Absolutely. I just trying to keep my finger on the pulse of the industry. You know, what we had last year was a lot of states with massive agricultural economies who were simply too late to the game. And the biggest of that is Texas. I had a great phone call this week with somebody down in West Texas who just gave me a flavor of the history of
was
cotton.
Was it the West Texas town of El Paso?
It was not. It was a little bit closer to Lubbock, I believe. But it was, you don't think about what cotton has done for that part of the country. It is really, really fascinating. And their entire economy is built around it, from farming to processing, their universities and how, where people go to get their education. It's unbelievable. And so the interest in Texas right now around hemp fiber is just unbelievable. The interest for hemp fiber across the South in the United States is unbelievable, because more than likely they have multiple production seasons, whereas up north there's a very, very short window to grow a hemp crop, and it's primarily for grain. I really do think this is going to be the year of fiber, and I think we're going to see that industrial side and that whole plant approach really explode. You know, part of that that discussion was, even down in Texas, while fiber is the main thrust, they do not want to waste those other components of the plant. They want to have a solution for the flour that comes off of there. They want to try to have a solution for grain. And everybody is just chomping at the bit for these livestock studies to finally come down with an approval for feeding hemp grain to animals, which is just, you know, probably going to be a floodgate moment as far as these contracts that have, you know, up to this day been hard to find. And you talk to some of these guys who grow thousands of acres, and they're like, if we had a contract, this would be a no-brainer. I think we are getting very, very, very close. And while we did see a contraction in acres this year, I think that's for the best. You know, we saw people finally realizing that, you know, planting for CBD was probably too late to do that. And then you had a lot of folks who weren't going to do a lot of production for grain or fiber, but as a way to just cut your teeth. I mean, 2020 was a perfect year for that. And 2021 offers some really exciting things. So I think it's going to be a pretty good year, Bob. I would say this, because this is something that I think is kind of near and dear to our hearts, which is the importance of context and the importance of a sound business plan. I think this is a good time for businesses to go and seek those business advisory services, to seek counsel on where the market is going and where should I pivot my business. If I'm having trouble with my market, if I'm having trouble identifying a buyer, it's a really good time to go and seek some context and some expertise. I don't know if you kind of share that sentiment, but this is kind of a reset time. And, you know, we definitely know and have those networks to help people find a good path for their business to get on.
Agreed on everything you said. Let's start there. The idea of context. I mean, farmers are generally smart people. You don't make it as a farmer, and you don't make it in that industry without understanding pretty deeply how it works and how the soil is going to treat it, et cetera. But unfortunately, because there's no defined marketplace around hemp products in the U.S. right now, that's just ingrained and established, there's a risk to so many farmers that hear or read that if I plant CBD, I'm going to make tens of thousands of dollars per acre, $60,000, $100,000 per acre, whatever the number is. And again, we've talked about this. That may have happened for a few years, but it doesn't work like that. And most farmers are too smart to take that get rich quick scheme, but there are so many others that just don't have enough context or contacts, people that can help educate them on where things are. But it's less sexy to talk about the industrial, the fiber, the grain, the other uses of the plant besides cannabinoid production, but it really is the bread and butter of farming. And it's what farmers have done for a long, long time. So as long as they have context, understand what that supply chain looks like, and have the right advisors and genetic providers, they can be set off on the right foot. Now, the year of fiber, I really like that. And, you know, you talk about Lubbock, Texas, of course, where Texas Tech is, and Texas Tech is one of the leading fiber institutes in the United States. And because it's cotton country, and why would you stop planting cotton and plant hemp? In part because there's other uses to the plant, whereas cotton's fairly narrow to just fiber, but also importantly, the water consumption. You probably know the numbers better than I do, but industrial hemp takes a lot less water than cotton. I don't know what the percentage is, but it's a lot less. So, and that's an area that's arid and dry to begin with. And, you know, around the world, we're seeing more drought-like conditions. And then another part that's near and dear to me about Lubbock, Texas, is if you stand on two pennies, you have to look really, really far. And it's only a little blip on the map, but there is a place called Hoban, Texas. Named after a Jesuit missionary named Bishop Hoban, who traveled the Southwest, proselytizing Christianity many, many, many years ago. And it is a little blip on the map, and I hope to get there someday. More importantly, I hope hemp is planted in Hoban, Texas someday.
That's a day we can all look forward to, Bob. there's also the Buddy Holly Museum.
The Buddy Holly Museum is, in fact, in Lubbock, Texas. And by the way, Texas Tech campus is quite beautiful. It's a really great school with a big population. And it's a great area. But the Buddy Holly Museum, for those of us that grew up with, hangovers of the or the holdovers from the 60s music, the Buddy Holly, the Richie Valens, the Big Bopper, all of these folks, it really brought a lot back, and it's really a great place to go visit. So there's a lot to be seen in places that are just flat and broad and seemingly barren, but the furthest thing from being barren. Absolutely. When you really dig into it.
Yeah, and on that year of the fiber, it's very possible that we could see an oversupply come next fall of people who grew thousands of acres of hemp for fiber and simply not enough end markets for that. But
the markets are there. It's just the purchasers don't know that we don't have the infrastructure to provide the consistency of material to the end purchasers. You've got Levi's, you've got Wrangler, you've got other textile manufacturers that have committed to begin using more and more hemp fiber. But that's because they understand where their supply is going to come from, and ultimately they control that processing element, so they're getting the fiber exactly the way they want it, which is going to be the key for hemp substitute uses on anything, whether that's plastic or otherwise. You need to be able to create that hemp product, that hemp material or derivative, whether it's for plastics, fibers, or otherwise, that can be used within existing systems that meets their existing specs of uniformity and standards. And that's where we're not at yet. We can get there. We get there relatively quickly. But that's, I think, the holdup on the other end. And that's where, to your point, some farmers are going to lose. They're going to lose.
Well, you're exactly right, Bob, and an oversupply issue would actually, in my mind, not be a bad thing, because we've had for so long this chicken and egg problem with hemp here in the U.S. There's not enough of a supply. There's not enough processors. Unlike biomass, hemp bales of fiber are fairly easy to store, and having that oversupply is only going to lead to probably more research and development to get to these end uses. And unlike CBD, or unlike biomass for CBD, there are so many verticals that those stocks could go into. If it's not the long fiber for textiles, it could be the short fiber for herd, for plastics, for paper, for construction materials, just a whole manner of things that we're just kind of waiting for that supply to come online so that we can actually do the research that's needed to do. It may come back a little bit on the farmer, not necessarily profiting as much off of their crop as they could, but these are the challenges of a burgeoning nascent industry. And it's an exciting time. I think there's something to be said for just holding this positive attitude going into 2021. And I think there's a lot of great content to look forward to on the Hoban Minute this year. Cause we're planning on having some pretty cool conversations with some people who are really going to try to help us shepherd us through this complex time we're living in to get us to a beautiful hemp and marijuana cannabis industry set up here in the years to come.
It's the beauty of this industry too, because it's new and because you've got regional and global changes. You've got political changes. You've got technology changes. You don't know what's in the, it's like a good book, right? You don't know what that next chapter is going to be about, or if new characters are going to be introduced, or a new TV series or whatever, or a new season in a television show. You don't know what's going to happen in that series, but you know you like what you see already, and that next thing's exciting. Who saw what they threw at us in November with the United Nations changes, the MORE Act, many countries around the world, many states that Virginia, places that would never have considered cannabis legalization, are moving forward with things. So we don't know what's around the corner, but suffice to say that with a positive outlook and coupled with, you know, some economic desperation, there's good things ahead for cannabis. So I look forward to the next chapter. I look forward to the next season of this, because who knows what's around the corner?
Yeah, no idea what tomorrow brings, but we'll be covering it here on the Hoban Minute in flying colors. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Hoban Minute. Do you have any ideas for episode topics or guests? We would like to hear from you. Reach out to us at media@hoban.law and stay tuned for more on the Hoban Minute.